Discover the path to success in the golf industry with GBN University Podcast. Hosted by retired Colonel Spencer Coulat, PhD, this educational series delves into leadership, finance, merchandising, and more. Join us on the journey to greatness. Subscribe now for expert insights and strategies.
Welcome back, team. I'm your host, Spencer Coulat. We're here today on Getting Better Now, and we are honored to have Cameron Doan, the director of golf at Preston Trail. And you guys, you've been there for a good while. I know that, Cameron. And I mean, the signal is that they're happy with you and you're a valued teammate there. So the members of your club, I can only imagine. I've only spent a little time with you, but I want more time with you. So I'm sure they're in that same boat, that they want you there more and more. So let me just open it up to you with any opening comments, and then we'll get down this slow walk of meeting you and your start into the world. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks, Spencer, and thanks for having me on. And I have been here. I'm in my 25th year, and it's a great group of folks I get the chance to work for a lot of reasons. It's about golf, but it's really about people here. And they want to come have a good time, and they support what we do, developing young people to go lead other operations, which is the purpose for me. So I'm looking forward to chatting this morning, and hopefully the things we talk about can help some young folks along the way and maybe even give a couple of new ideas to a couple of old ward horses.
And I have been pleasantly surprised. When I first started this, everybody said that the older guys would be less open to learning new things or whatever. And it is the exact opposite, that the wisdom in this industry is more on the side of being curious and learning new ways to think about it. And I love that you've already dropped one pearl there. I think the most important job of leaders is to make more leaders. And that I've heard you now twice, and you start with that every time. So I really appreciate that. Before we get to your how you grew up and how you got into this industry, I want to make sure everybody understands that you've been a competitive PGA pro. Give us a little bit maybe of what you've competed in, and how does that feel when you get up against, I can't even imagine standing up and playing on the crowd. And I watch a lot of Sunday golf. I've got some days planned out. We're also do some deep couch sitting and watch professional golf. So where have you competed, and how has that been for you?
So I do still love to compete. I'm an old guy at 55, but one of the things that I do, I've always got at least one or two young guys that can really play, and that keeps me going. I still love to mix it up. I have had a chance to compete at a lot of different levels. I played in college at Texas El Paso. My roommate for 4 years was a guy named Paul Stankowski, who won twice on tour. And he actually saved me some time and effort. I did not go to Q school because I couldn't beat him. I beat him 2 out of 10 times when we played, and didn't know at the time I was rooming with a guy that was going to win on the tour. So I have enjoyed being among the best players in the two different sections I've worked in. I've enjoyed being able to show my members how the game is played. I've won a lot of section events in both places. I played on a lot of cup teams. My two biggest highlights, I played in the Byron Nelson Championship here in Dallas 3 times with my dad caddying before he passed. And that probably is the best. That's probably the highlight for me. And then last spring, played in the Senior PGA Championship here at PGA Frisco. They arranged it so I hit the opening shot, and I had my son get in for me there. And I had a bunch of members out, had a bunch of North Texas people out, had some high school buddies come, played good, made the cut, was in the hunt, got to play with Paul Stankowski, my college roommate, 3 of the 4 days. So I don't think I'm old enough to say I'm done, but that was kind of a complete in the circle thing for me with my son being able to be in that arena with me. That was cool.
Man, I love that generational feel, that not only you were part of receiving probably, I can already hear, good payment forward from your dad, but you have done that same thing. I can just feel it for your son. And I get goosebumps thinking about it, because these are the things you can't buy. You can't buy that trust, and you don't get to pick your family all the time, but it is the most important thing in my life. And I can already tell, it sounds like for you, yeah, it's the most important thing in your life. So that is awesome. So tell, if you could, because I wonder at the end of all this, like where we are now, and we're very close in age, we talked about this, but like where you are now and then how you grew up, like where did you grow up? And if you can just give us any of the stakeholders in your life, how did you develop? Who is Cameron Doan at UT El Paso, you know, when you start this?
So I grew up in a small mining town in southern New Mexico called Silver City. Had a 9-hole golf course with no driving range. And my dad was the golf pro and the superintendent and the parks director. I took care of the swimming pool, took care of the cemetery. Not many jobs like that anymore. And I have a brother that's a couple of years younger. And from the age of 5 or 6, when we weren't in school, we were hanging out at my dad's golf course. So it was a great way to grow up. You know, you grow up the way you grow up. And at the time, you don't know any different. But looking back, I was lucky. I was really lucky. A lot of great people in that town. Spent that much time with my dad. The people that played at that golf course raised my brother and I. And one of the cool things about a town like that with only one course, it is a melting pot. So the doctors and lawyers and real estate guys and the people that ran the town were there. The teachers and coaches were there. The guys driving the trucks at the mine were there. The police officers were there. It's the complete mix. And I grew up learning how to get along with people from all walks of life, all different nationalities, a couple of different languages. It just couldn't have been any better. Figuring out how to get along with the world, realizing it's not about you. So I was lucky. My dad played college golf and played it. He also played at Texas El Paso. His college golf coach happened to be a guy named Don Haskins. So Don Haskins was a basketball coach at UTEP for 35 years and won a national championship in 1966, which changed the game a little bit because he was the first guy to start 5 black guys. So he was the golf coach in name, but not, he wasn't coaching. One of his assistants was driving the bus. But my dad got to be around that, and he was a sports guy. So he passed that on to my brother and I. So we played football and basketball when golf wasn't going on. And again, didn't know it at the time, but like, you know, you grow up in a locker room, you hang around a bunch of guys in a locker room, you figure out how to get along. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really matter where everybody's coming from. You're rallying around each other to try to go beat the team on the other side of the field. And you learn how to play your role. You learn how to go where your coaches tell you to go. You learn how to get knocked down and get back up. You learn what it's like to lose and be disappointed. You learn what it's like to win and just feel on top of the world. All that stuff was just spectacular.
Yeah, those are all the beautiful things of sport that that's what has attracted me. I always tell people, I'm like, the common denominator in my life has been a helmet and a chin strap. And I think that's why I like the military so much, is that, you know, I was a linebacker in my high school football team, and that was everything in the world to me. I was a strong safety my junior year, but my senior year, I was kind of an undersized linebacker. And I already texted my high school coach today. He texts me every morning. He finishes a squirrel hunt and sends me off a little message. And I feel so honored to be part of that group of people. It's a smaller group of people he texts, but the density and viscosity of our relationship is so deep. And he taught me how to be a man, especially when my dad was passing away and I needed him in my life. So it sounds like your dad was that same dude, because the local park at my hometown is named after my dad now. And it didn't have a golf course, but he was a community leader and he raised many kids in our neighborhood. And it sounds like your dad was in that same kind of boat, you know? And you're aware enough to be grateful. That's what I really appreciate. You're aware enough to be grateful for that lottery pick. So, yeah, that is really nice. Now, let me ask you this. Now, and this may be a little off topic, but I got an argument with one of my buddies the other day. Have you ever heard this whole X's and O's versus Jills and Joes or whatever, however they want to say it? Like, coaching, does it matter or does it not matter? And I so firmly stand like, hey, leadership matters and coaching matters. Like, is it just the recruiting battle? Because I got buddies of mine, you know, we're big SEC fans. I'm here right now in Baton Rouge at LSU. And, you know, the argument was about Saban or pick a coach if you'd like. But I firmly believe you could have all the talent in the world, and still fail if you have the wrong leadership. I'm asking this softball question to you because I feel like me and you are on the same page, like coaching matters, right?
Coaching matters huge. Coaching, yeah. So one of the great lines, and I think this was probably a Bear Bryant thing they talked about back in his day. He was such a good coach. He could take his players and beat yours, or he could take your players and beat his. And does talent matter? Sure. But if you got a bunch of talent that's running in different directions, you can't beat somebody. If you've got pretty good talent that's all swimming in the same direction, you got something there. So, yeah, coaching in my organization, leadership, putting people in the roles that they're going to be successful in. So that football example, you know, you got a guy playing left tackle. Well, he's probably not going to handle a slot very well if you make him a slot receiver, is he?
No.
So that leadership of everybody's got a handful of things they're good at, and everybody's got a handful of things they're probably not good at. And one of the things I think great leaders do is they put individuals in places where their strengths are going to help the team, and they hide their weaknesses. And they'll work on their weaknesses, but when you're going to strap it up and go play a game, you're not putting that left tackle as a slot receiver. You're going to put him in there left tackle. And you might work on making him a little quicker and a little leaner during the week, but you're not doing it on Saturday.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it takes some buy-in from the team. Like, you have to subordinate yourself to the goal. That left tackle may saw himself as a receiver growing up his whole life, but can he subordinate himself to the real outcome, which is winning, and his participation in that outcome? And a lot of people can't do it. You got to put the ego away and trust the team. And I feel like you've probably been that guy for a long time. Like, you were competitive. If you're this competitive, you're probably a very good football player, and you're a very good basketball player as well in high school. I think you said you played both of those. Like, how do you get to golf? Because you were probably competitive in most of these.
So I was a quarterback, so I was on the other side of the ball from you.
Yeah.
Being in a town that small with one school, the football tradition was already strong.
Mm-hmm.
So fourth, fifth, sixth grade, you're going to the Friday night game, and those guys running around on that football field that are juniors and seniors in high school, those were our guys. We'd have done anything to be them.
Mm-hmm.
So we grew up with that as our aspiration. And again, not knowing what I was knowing now, the coach who had been there, he started in 1976. I graduated from high school in 86. So the structure he put in place, we were running the offense in eighth grade that the guys were running at the varsity level.
Yeah.
And when we first got to play in his eighth grade, this is genius. Again, I didn't know it at the time, but the guy that was the eighth grade coach had a gift for knowing what position to put guys in.
Mm-hmm.
He told me the end of my seventh grade year, football didn't start till eighth grade. He said, "Hey, you're playing quarterback." He told me 4 months before we got going, he'd watched me go through PE and basketball that was played in seventh grade. He'd already decided the guys that were going to play on offensive line, even if they thought they were going to be at a skill position, he told them ahead of time. So genius to get kids in the right place. And then you spend 4 years running the same offense and the same defense. You already know your role. So by the time we got to high school, we weren't worried about the glory of the individual stuff. We weren't thinking, I don't get the ball enough. We knew what our job was. And,
yeah,
you know, the system grew a little and got a little more complex, but the core of it was the same. So we've been running the same place for 4 years. And we ended up getting the state championship when I was a senior, and unfortunately, we did not win. That would have been the better story.
Yeah, yeah.
We got beat by 2 points. But, yeah, it was a great, great lesson, whole bunch of lessons.
Yeah. Yeah.
The competitive part of me, you asked a question about that. I probably loved football more than golf, but I also knew I wasn't going to go very far. There was the guy that had been the quarterback two classes ahead of me. Had gone and played college football, and his dad and my dad were tight. They were both golf. That family was also full of golfers. And he got his knees blown out second year. And I remember him coming back in a wheelchair. He had both knees operated on at the same time. And that kind of showed me, okay, maybe there's not a lot of future on the football side. And I didn't have any big schools chasing me, but I had the D1 schools within 250 miles of the town I grew up, UTEP, UNM, Arizona, were talking to me. So that made the decision pretty easy, to be honest.
Yeah. What pops out in my head really quickly is that, you know, now more and more, my brother has some kids that are at this stage of their life where you were, you know, like, and they're trying to specialize in a sport. And I really enjoy to hear, I just love hearing the broad scope of your history, and you can still be a great golfer, you know, but play some other sports. And like, I don't know, today, sometimes I think we lose sight of the outcome, or we lose sight of thinking like the outcome is more important than the teamwork and the process to get there. Like, how important is the process? And you're probably still using that today. Like, the club you run today is more about building the process, and you can see it. If you do the process correct, at least John Wooden said, he never talked about winning. He didn't talk about the outcome. He talked about making each other better every day. That's us on getting better now. You know, like, you probably still use that stuff today, right?
No question. No. Yeah. So John Wooden, interesting thing, you know, he had his pyramid of success. And I've got it right here on my wall.
Yeah.
And in 2011, we made one for the golf business. So we took the concept and we changed what was in each of the building blocks to fit the golf business. But it's the same stuff. So every guy that works for me gets a copy of that.
Yeah. That's a good, I fall back on him so much, and I've read every one of the books and people written about him, and the assistant coaches that wrote about him. Like, I mean, obviously he was blessed with some talent, but I don't think they do what they do at UCLA without Coach Wooden's expertise and that kind of strategy and enjoying the process. So
here's a great Wooden story. Yeah. This just popped in my head. So
yeah,
you remember Bill Walton?
Yes. He's one of the talent that I'm thinking about on that team. Yeah.
So one of those stories I read about Wooden, because I've read everything that's been written about him. So when Walton came back for his senior year, but back then freshmen couldn't play. And so they won in his sophomore and junior year, and he was a national player of the year as a junior. And if I remember right, he was from Oregon. Yeah. And he came rolling back to school beginning of his senior year and had big old long shaggy hair and the beard and kind of the grunge look. And you know, Wooden wasn't going for that. You were going to look the way Wooden told you to look. So Wooden had seen him on campus and hadn't said anything to him about it. First day of practice, Walton shows up looking like that. And Coach Wooden pulls him aside and says, Bill, it's good to have you back. We had a really good year last year. I think we can have a good year this year. I know you understand what the grooming standards are to be a Bruin, and you're not meeting them, so you're not going to practice today. Look forward to having you back once you've got your standards cleaned up. And if you feel like this is not for you anymore, we're going to miss you, but we're going to keep going. So I'm going to excuse you for the day and let me know what you decide. So Walton showed up the next day, hair was cut, clean shaven, off they went and won another title. And think about, that's just, talk about leadership. He put it on him.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that great leaders do. They're not, I mean, do they scream and yell a little bit? Yeah. But most of the time, they're just explaining to the people they're leading. Here's what it's going to take. I'll be right in there with you, but I can't do it for you. You got to want it.
Yeah. See, and that's, when I put these economic leader, these principles up there, the first one is opportunity costs and trade-offs. And what Coach Wooden did in that story is narrowed down exactly what the trade-off was. So now, you know, young Bill Walton has to make a choice about, do I value this grunge, the crunchy that I think is me, over this teammate, the teammates I have, and what I'm going to be a part of as part of the UCLA Bruin. Very clearly, two pathways, you make the choice. But when he did that, he set the prices for everybody else too. And what the signal is like, we're not individuals here. We're going to subordinate ourselves to the mission. The mission is boss, and all of us fall in line with the mission. And as a military dude, I'm in that game. I love that. You know, like, hey, here's the, if I walk past a standard that I have said is part of who we are. I just reset what the prices are for everyone. And I think it was, I know it's your quote, actually, because I was like, man, that is a great quote. And this is what you're saying, too. This is from the PGA show. I'm pretty sure it's you saying, I'm making it legal for everyone to live like I'm living. Was that you?
That was me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly what you're saying. Like, as a leader in our military, like, you embody the standards that you expect of everyone. And it is all about fair. As human beings, we're very quick to know what fair is. And as valuable as Bill Walton is on that team, it wouldn't have been fair for him to have a beard and the kid who's the 12th man on that bench or the 15th dude on that bench to show up at practice every day and be the practice dude against Walton and stick with the standards. And for Coach Wooden to stand up and say, I am willing to risk all this talent over this beard or whatever it is. I don't care what it is. There's some standard. He, by doing that, he sets it for everybody. And now you listen to Bill Walton. He still got his tie-dye shirt on when he calls the game, but all he can do is praise Coach Wooden.
Yeah, he does. You're right. When he's commentating, he brings up Wooden every game I've ever heard him call. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He knows.
I love that. Yeah. And that's being part of a team. I think that's something that both you and I have been blessed with, is that we came from a community with a diverse group of people around us. And we all, it didn't matter if you were driving the truck, like all work was honorable. Like you could be the best truck driver out there. The lawyer surely probably made more money. That doctor absolutely made more money, but that didn't make him a better or worse human being if you were the truck driver. Like all work was honorable. I feel like we have that connection. Yeah. So that I love that. Now, if you take all those ideas on a team, because I work with the Army golf team as the officer representative. So I'm like a glorified chaperone with this team of kids that we recruit to West Point. And then they're pretty good golfers. They have specialized. Most of them have not played many sports like you did. Actually, probably one of the best team captains I saw did. He was a very good pitcher up until his junior year of high school. And then he came to golf, late to golf, right? In today's world. And he was probably the best team captain I saw out there. How do you take that same teamwork? Because I remember Coach Bagley, our he's my classmate, but he's our coach up in Army, Chad Bagley. And trying to create a team in an individual sport like that. Like as a player, how did you feel? Like how did it feel teammate? Like, because we had a kid, an assistant that went to, I say a kid, a very good young man, Justin Barget, went to University of Illinois after being the assistant at Army. And we were at the Augusta State tournament, which is a blessing they let us come to that. They got some real power hitting teams there. And I said, hey, Justin, you mind if I go talk to some of your Illinois players? And their mindset was so different. Like they are going to be PGA players, probably. Some of them are. And their mindset was so different than our Army team. Like, how did you deal with that as a college player? Like, we're creating a team, but we're all doing individual stuff.
So that's an excellent question. I think it's very, very difficult to create a true team environment in college golf. And to be perfectly candid, the environment I played in my college golf team, it was not good. In large part because we were always trying to beat each other. And there was some constant strife there. You know, if I was going to go back and be a college golf coach, I haven't thought about this. I've thought about this at all, but here's what I think I would do. I would look him in the eye at the beginning of each season, okay, the competitive part of things when we're at a tournament, I want you guys trying to shoot the lowest number you can, trying to win the golf tournament yourself. Mm-hmm. There's some things we're going to do be a team. I'll explain what those are in a minute. Understand that the team success is what I'm here for, but I will do all I can to make you the best individual players you can be for the entire time you're here, and I will help you get your future set up best I can. What you've got to do for me is make the team concept work. We're going to work out together. We're going to study together. We're going to travel together. We're not going to play the same way because that's not how golf works. Mm-hmm. So I just be honest with you. But I would create the team stuff because, and this is something you talk about your captain. That's interesting. The guys that come to work for me here, I want guys that played college golf, but I really don't want guys that only played college golf. I want guys that played other sports because people that only played golf are kind of selfish. Mm-hmm. Because in order to compete at the AJGA level and being in a top 20 program and a tour player, you better be selfish when you're between the ropes. But life's a team sport. So I'm working on stuff bigger than that.
Yeah. It's so weird to me because these are two ideas which I totally buy into. And I think the poles of it are somewhere between like competitive, which I totally believe in, free markets and the allocation of scarce resources. I like totally believe in that. And then like fully cooperative or collaborative, like on the other end of that. My high school football coach, Doug Morrow, tell us, well, or he said, you will always work harder for your buddy than you will for yourself. Like you're going to lay it on the, in that weight room, you're going to throw bigger weights for your buddy than you will for yourself. You're going to find things in you that are bigger and better than if it were just you. Like nobody can push you more than your buddy. And I love that idea. Like we are, I am my brother's keeper and we are here to cooperate. Like that takes the subordination of me for the goal. Now I'm part of that. I'm at, now the competitive side of that, I'm not my brother's keeper. I'm here to be selfish and go to the lowest number I can between the ropes, you know? And I think it's not a pole. It's not here or there. It's kind of a rheostat, which is controlled by the coach. Like it's dimming the lights. Sometimes you got to move towards competitive. And sometimes you got to move toward cooperative. Like, but they have to understand that just as well. And we've done a great job of that in this country, in my idea. I mean, listen, we have grown our gross domestic product bigger than anybody in the world. Like this works, you know? And but when I see it in organizations, like even now, what you just explained, I think that is a real challenge for leaders. Like, how do you create competitive iron sharpens iron, but then also cooperative and tuck it away? Because the worst thing you do in my first company and in any army experience I've been in is go ahead and have a good idea for your platoon and don't spread it to the other platoons. Like that's nasty stuff. Like my bosses would, they'll chop you down for that. Like don't sit on, don't be selfish. So these two ideas have been very, because I believe in free markets and I also believe in cooperation. And that is, you know, when you called it how to get along, like that's a very important piece of that. How do you put trust inside of that, the cooperative and the competitive? And even in your job today, sitting down, you're going to deal with some adversity today. How do you do that now?
Yeah, that's, wow, that's great
stuff. Sorry.
That's great stuff. I love it.
I eat drink coffee. Yeah, you yeah. do that. Yeah.
So trust, that's a big word, and it's an important word. I think it starts with the guys that work together, looking at each other as human beings.
Yeah.
Not just as a guy I'm working with. So our whole place is a locker room. And the way that trust happens is we're going to play golf together. We're going to go have dinner and drink a beer together. I pair them up doing things. So you talked about, I am your brother's keeper. If I got a young man who's struggling a little bit with his game, and let's say his short game's not very good, then I'll talk to one of the guys whose short game is good and say, hey, go spend some time with him and see if you can help him get organized. Figure out what he's struggling with. Maybe it's just as simple as he's practicing. So I create that collaborative situation you just talked about. So I also believe, and this is a Nick Saban thing, the veterans train the rookies.
Yeah.
So when somebody goes to work for us, I don't teach them how things are going to go. And everybody starts working in the outside service operation here. And, well, they're going to learn how we park carts and how we set the range up and how we pull bags and what our communication is with the parking lot and from the guys that are already doing it. So the trust starts that day. And one of the things I will do, so I bet you have this a lot, probably once a quarter, one of my veterans will come and we're having a conversation. He'll complain about one of the rookies and not getting it done. I said, okay, so do you think he drove in yesterday and decided that he wanted to do the worst job he possibly could? Or do you think maybe you didn't do a great job of explaining to him how to do it and what's expected? Which of those is most likely? And they kind of look at me and say, okay, you got me. And I say, you know, those guys are going to be as good as you make them. So you're telling me that you're not a very good coach when you're complaining about the way he's doing his job.
Man, I love that. So like, that is, you know, my buddy, Major General Pat Work, he was the Army's middle linebacker. I mean, one of the toughest men I've ever met on the face of earth. Like, he was the last dude in Mosul to clean it up as a brigade commander. And now he's the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division. And he would come up and speak up at West Point to us, to our cadets. And he would go to the classroom. He didn't want to speak to a big crowd. Like, he'd go to the classroom. And I would always ask him at the end of it. I'm like, in economics, they call it a free rider. Like, I'm enjoying the benefits without suffering all the costs. And I'm like, Pat, how do you, General Work, how do you squeeze out the free riders that are just kind of making long? And you know his answer was? The exact same thing you just said. He believes in the good nature of every human being out there. It's like my old man used to say, like, hey, everybody cried when old Yeller died, you know? And my old man believed in the good nature of each human being. And he always put the mirror back on himself. Like, if I haven't found it, then it's my problem. Like, I got to figure out what's motivating this kid. And I mean, the way you're attacking it, I love that idea, because it's a principal agent problem. You're the principal and you got agents working on your behalf. That is your interface with the customer. Like, and the first thing matters, you know? And how do you get your ideas, your expectation of what that looks like down to them? And, you know, Phil's, OMB's, we and him have talked about this over and over again, but the principal agent problem is alive and well everywhere. And the way to do it is trust and culture. And you said it. You said, I don't teach them, the dude, the agent at the lowest level. The veterans train the workers. So how do you maintain that culture? How do you maintain that? And how do you empower those middle leaders that are the veterans? How do you empower them? How do you treat their failures? Like, it sounds like with an open mind, kind of. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So, again, this is the same language you're speaking. I believe people really want three things out of where they're working.
Yeah.
They want to be doing something they enjoy. They want to be some part of something bigger than themselves. And they want to see room for improvement / development / growth. So my job as the leader of this place is to create conditions where those three things exist. First rule I have to hire somebody is they need to love golf. And I can't make them love golf. And that doesn't mean they have to shoot 68 every time they play. They could be a kid that struggles to pass the PAT and he struggles to break 80 in a section event, but he can still love it. You got to love it, because that's our common language. We're in the hospitality business, but it's around golf. So that's number one. And then the intangibles they need to bring with them. They need to be intellectually curious. They need to be intelligent enough that they can learn. Because I can't change that. I can't make somebody smarter.
Yeah.
I can make them wiser, but I can't make them smarter.
Yeah.
They need to be willing to be part of a team. And they need to be okay with working hard when it's time to work hard. And if you give me somebody that brings those things with them, then we plug them into what we do and they're going to be successful.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, more and more, like, who would have thought that? I don't know. When I started down this pathway, people were like, well, how are you going to do leadership with PGA? I'm like, it's just human interactions. And I believe the PGA professionals are some of the best out there in collecting information about people. Because you said it. I mean, I've heard Phil or Patrick, somebody said, like, hey, golf is a commodity. We're in the hospitality business. And if you're in the hospitality business and you're about gaining information, and if you're about gaining information, then you have to know who you are first. Like, self-awareness, I think, is something you talked about. And then I think about your humility and courage enough to go, hey, that kid on the other end of the side, he's got self-awareness too. I have to think about, and if you genuinely care for them, I'll flip a page back. You talked about that. The trust just comes in genuine care for each person. So, like, you can't fake that. You can't fake it. You can try, but I think people have got good radar on this stuff. So, I mean, how, I don't know. I don't know how to do it for a younger professional. If you can think to yourself as you left college and you got on this pathway, you know, what kind of things did you do? What would you tell a young PGA professional right now who's trying to do this to be you? How do they collect good information? How did you learn to collect good information on the people that work for you and then the members that you're trying to keep happy? How do you do that?
You ask questions. It's as simple as that. And I wasn't good at it when I was young. But, you know, to be honest, in my case, I was probably better at it than most people in their early 20s because of the way I grew up. Like I talked about earlier, that melting pot that on that public golf course, I learned how to talk to people. I didn't know I was learning that, but I knew what each person's job was. I knew who their kids were. So what I do now and what I get our young guys to do, you start off by finding out where somebody went to college. And they're probably going to have at least a little bit of pride in where that is. So now you got something to talk to them about. Find out how many kids they've got. Find out how many siblings they've got. And you end up with some kind of a thread with each person you deal with that you can go back and talk to them about instead of always talking about work. When I'm giving a golf lesson, if I'm spending an hour with somebody, that entire hour is not spent on the technical part of the game. I'm going to get to know them. And I'm going to show them I'm interested in them. And we're going to break between shots and talk about where their kids are in school or what their dad was like. Or again, it goes back to that personal interaction, that connection. So I think I actually said this in that room at the show. Somebody, when we went to the end and went to the Q&A, one of the young professionals in the back of the room, who I didn't know, I don't remember who it was, asked us, okay, what do you think's the future's like? Our business. And I said, I believe it's strong because all of the technology in the world is reducing human interaction. And our entire livelihood is built around human interaction. And people need that, whether they know it or not. So that's, we're never going to get artificial intelligence out. We're not going to get pushed out by technology because they need us. They don't always know it. That's our hook.
Yeah. Yeah. You're dead on. It's on my notes 404, and it's you talking about AI will never do a strong people person job. Like, and I agree with you. Like, it's another tool, just like a calculator was a tool. It can help me do the math quicker. I can take an Excel spreadsheet and be very good at it. But I mean, I don't know where this stuff will go, but I think AI is another tool. But you're in the people person business. And I don't know how, if a person didn't have the same community you grew up in, because I totally buy that, you know, if you came from a diverse community and the community helped raise you. I've said that so many times in my life. I feel so grateful for that. So like the younger professionals out there, it's almost like, you know, making that four footer. If you press too hard and you talk when you should be listening, then it's probably going to be a harder, you know, 5-footer, 6-footer to make, you know. Right. If you do it naturally and develop and hang out with people who do it well, then you're going to see how natural it can become. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, something else about young professionals, and I talk to my guys all the time about this. So the tactical part of the golf business is really not very complicated. So there's some computer stuff with POS systems and tournament software and tee sheets and payroll. And you got to be able to run in spreadsheets. Yeah. You got to be able to do all that stuff. But if you got through college, you probably can figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
What differentiates the ones that people gravitate to and that get the really good jobs are the ones that can make the connection with people, can make sure that their members or their customers at a public golf course are enjoying their experience. And they can build a team that will deliver exactly what those people want and be happy to do it. That's the separate.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I think you guys do such a good job with. I think part of that too, and I think it was your quote again, I hate to go back to this PGA show, but I learned a lot from you back there. And I think it was you. Somebody's talking away because you have a personal life. You got a family at the house, right?
Yeah.
That's yeah, right. We could talk about them at the end, but like you got things going on in your life too. And the last thing your members want is to show up and have you come, you know, bring in your baggage to the course. And that's a big ask. Like that's a hard thing to deal with, I think. Like I feel like a young leader in our army has that same thing. Like, listen, I know you got problems going on, but your young soldiers don't need that face. They need the guy that is going to explain the why and coordinate their efforts for the day. Like, that's a challenge. So what advice would you give on managing that well? Was it you that said that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. So you got to know that about their life away from the job and care about it. But exactly what you just said, you got to explain, hey, look, when you're here, you got to be here.
Yeah.
When you're not here, when you're at home, be present there. But when you're here, let's go all in. And if you're really having a hard time, raise your hand, ask me for help. We'll go sit in the office, close the door, and we'll talk through it. Been done that a lot, and there's been some tears.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You know, we could go down that road for an hour. but I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah.
I'm agreeing with you.
I know self-awareness is one of your pieces, and how do you build that? Like, I think it's the same thing. Like, how do you build self-awareness?
Are you seeking executive talent for your premier golf facility? The partners at GBN have decades of executive search experience recruiting the most accomplished leaders across the country. Our values drive every decision we make. We do what's right, always. With our extensive network, industry expertise, and diligent research, we'll find the perfect match to elevate your facility. Visit golfbusinessnetwork.com/executive search today to learn more.
So when I'm interviewing somebody, I'm trying to find out if they've got those intangibles I talked about earlier. And then once they get going with us, I ask them what their long-term career goal is. And I tell them, hey, look, I'm not going to hold you to this. You're 23 years old. You're going to change. But I want to know what you're thinking now. And we're going to coach you that way. And I'm going to let you know the things that I think you need to be successful to go down that path. At the same time, we're going to explain the things we need from you to be successful now in the role that you're in. And we're going to make a trade here. You get after it and play your role now. I'm going to prepare you for your role later.
Yeah, I love that. And you just use one of my terms I'm always saying, we're going to make a trade. And I think, you know, people are disappointed with me when I say this, but because they feel like it's mechanical, like if we're just making a trade. But I believe that trust is built over many, many iterations of showing commitment and creating a win-win. And that may be today, you know, wiping the seat off because there's due. Like, you're doing what's expected of you over and over. You're meeting and exceeding expectations in a job that you know your part, and then you start to expand your part. Like, you showing that your third thing, that you have you're developing for that person, generally, a pathway for future development and growth. Yeah. And you got to get through the first two, like you said. You know, you got to enjoy it. You can't be passionate without it. And you got to be willing to realize that you want to be on a team that's bigger than yourself, you know, to do that. But creating that win-win, I think, is first requires information. And I think that's what, I mean, that's the common thing in all the PGA professionals. And I think, I mean, just your background uniquely fits it well with all the teams you've been on in your life, that you know how to create a win-win. And one of the hard questions I think that's worth asking is treating failure in your organization. Because what you do at the point of failure, how you treat everyone is going to set prices around the culture. Like, how do you do that when they, I don't know what, you don't have to give a specific example, but when you have failure for one of those middle managers, how do you change that or enforce it?
So I think what you got to do is eliminate to the extent you can the fear of failure.
Yeah.
Because people, when they're walking around or working, trying not to make a mistake, are never going to be the best version of themselves. So when we make a mistake, and we sure make them, my first rule is be honest about it. Bad news has to travel faster than good news.
Yeah.
And when something gets messed up, let me know. If I'm not here, let the highest ranking guy know. And figure out how to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
Apologize to the person that felt that mistake, and then have a conversation after. Okay, how did this happen? So were we not prepared? Did we just make a bad call in the heat of the moment? Did we let whatever emotions we had going from last night carry over? What was at the root of the failure? And just having that conversation and showing those young people that you're not going to scream at them when they make a mistake, they get better.
Yeah.
You know, that whole, and this is a coaching thing. The worst coach I ever had was my basketball coach when I was a sophomore in high school. And I actually quit the sport that year and didn't go back. And what he would do is, when a mistake was made by a player in practice, he'd stop practice, he'd put the whole team on the baseline, and we'd run a yo-yo.
Yeah.
Well, pretty soon, all we're trying to do is not screw up.
Yeah.
And when somebody does screw up, we're mad at him.
Yeah.
He had the exact opposite effect. Yeah. He thought what he was doing was getting us in better condition. He was turning us on each other. And I quit that team. I went to my dad after 2 months and said, I don't like the game anymore. Here's what this guy's doing. He said, okay, well, if you're going to do it, and this was a great dad lesson, you're going to schedule an appointment with a head varsity coach, and you're going to go in there and explain to him what's going on and why you want to be a part of it anymore.
Yeah.
But so that's the way we handle failure. Right? It's not that I'm okay with people making mistakes, but I understand them.
Yeah. And yeah. I appreciate that. Like, I agree. We're all broken timber. Like, it's going to happen, you know? And ownership, I think, is the first and most important. But the information is best right at the user level. Like, that's where the best information is at. And if you don't allow them the freedom of maneuver, they may not take risk that ultimately returns the best reward. If you get in that boat, you have tied your hands. You have tied, in the Army, we call it mission command philosophy. And always talk about command and control. How much are you going to control? The more I have to control, the less I trust. Or am I just going to be a commander where I'm in command but out of control? That's what General Work, my good buddy, would tell me. He's like, I'm in command but out of control. And the only way I can be out of control is that I trust. And I think that's what you've set up perfectly. So we do an after action review in the Army and military, like, and those things are hard. And if you do it right, people own up their mistakes. And that takes a lot of courage to, and if you've done it really weird, I've seen it happen where everyone starts to own up to their part of it. Like, I could have done this better. Wouldn't have put him in that position. Like, and it becomes like, you know, everybody's just exposing themselves. But every time we walk out of there, we've done something better. And you know what happens all the time is that the organizational conscience moves up. Because at the end of that, you're going to tell us, as the head leader, you're going to tell us how you would have controlled the situation now that you have the information. Like, that is, to me, is such a great opportunity for you, for us to learn. Our own organization will have its own math that it's doing. The organizational conscience goes up when we hear you address uncertainty. Like, how often do y'all do that? Do you bring everybody in?
Oh, yeah. So after we have an event, to the extent we can, depending on what time of day it is, if an event ends at sundown, it's easy. We gather everybody. And after action is exactly what we do. Say, okay, how did we do? So each event's got a mission. Well, the club championship is going to feel different from the member guest. Mm-hmm. So what qualifies as a win is going to look different. But I ask them point blank, all right, how do you guys think we did? What do you think we did well? What could we have done better? What did you need that you didn't have, whether it's information or resources? And when you ran into a situation, were you worried about it? Did you not understand the goal? Just talk it all through.
That says so much about you. You ask, see, because by just asking what resources that you didn't have that I can provide, it shows humility already, like, and awareness again, like, how, because I think that's what higher level commands are, resourcing commands. They're not action commands. Like, you're not, if you are, Pat, I hate to go back to General Work, but he's really solid. He calls it Mr. Next and Mr. Now. And as a senior leader, you should be Mr. Next. Like, you got to be thinking about what the next step is. If you're finding yourself being Mr. Now, like, if you're running around trying to solve those problems, we don't know what the next step is. So when you address, like, as a resourcing agent, like, you're a resourcing level of the leadership, it shows great humility to them. How can we provide more to you for your needs? That's tremendous. How many people in this room normally? Is it like 20, 30? I can't imagine.
So we'll have up to 15.
Yeah. Okay.
If it's an event where we still, it's over and we got a couple hours of daylight left and we still have members milling around, then it'll be a smaller group than that. And then I'll flip them. I'll bring half in. We'll talk about it and I'll send them out to run things and I'll bring the other half in.
Yeah.
And I, you know, we got a list going during the event. There's a piece of paper on the counter. Jot, if something goes sideways, jot it down and move on. And we'll come back and talk about it later.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that we kind of fail at sometimes in units that I've been in, is that we do a lot of lessons identified, but not lessons learned. Like we could walk away with 6 pages of notes and then fail to kind of learn those lessons. We identify them well, and then we don't learn them. Like, I think that's at least something in my head that I have failed at. So how do y'all do it for the next event? How do you overcome that?
So there's a list for, so let's take the member guest. We'll have a list of things that could be better next time, along with the mission of the event. And then my head professional's job, when we get to next year's member guest, a week out, he's going to send an email out with that document on it. Say, hey, guys, here's what we talked about after last year's was over, the things we wanted to tune in on and be better at. Just making it top of mind.
Yeah.
That's has a awesome. Huge impact.
Absolutely. Huge absolutely.
Simple right. stuff.
Yeah, it's simple, but it's not easy. Like, I feel like it is some pretty simple stuff, but it's definitely not easy. So, and it sounds like you've created great psychological safety, because we don't want to coach, like, we don't join teams for easy. I think, like, if it's valuable, then we understand it's going to be hard. Like when kids self-select to come to West Point or join our military, I don't want them to have to go back home and say, man, this was really easy. Like, no good story ever started out with, let me tell you how easy I had it. So like, we want it hard. Like, we want to be part of a high performing team. We understand that we may have to run some yo-yos, as you called them. You know, there's going to be some penance to be served. That's fine. It creates adversity and all the rest, but it can't go so far that you've ruined psychological safety and now people are not acting. Like,
yeah,
you haven't empowered, you haven't built trust. That's easily said, very hard to do.
Very hard to do. very hard to do. And it takes, you know, whoever the leader is, has got to have enough of a pulse on what's going on and enough control of his own ego to know when to twist and turn, because it's not the same with every team, or it's not the same every week. You got to adapt.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's back to your great awareness. Your radar is so good. And that's because I feel like when I talk about the production function all the time, like, hey, the scarce inputs that are coming in, the rules of the box, the black box, which is the production function, how we use those resources, and even the outcome, every one of those things is moving. There's nothing standing still.
Yeah.
And if you're not aware of all of those, then you're going to be caught behind the eight ball. You will never, I always called it, you're flying on the stabilator in a Blackhawk. The stabilator is the last wing back there behind, like, it's the flat piece. And I'm like, hey, come join me up in the cockpit, man. And I have been on the stabilator in my life because I can't manage the cockpit at 120 knots, you know, but you have to get up here to the front of the cockpit. And it means, I wrote down, and it's worth going back, you have to be able to be a good functional manager first. If you can't manage the software and you can't manage the books and you can't do all that other stuff, you're never going to get here. But ultimately, you have to create win-wins for people and build a team. That's your words that I just wrote down. It reinforces everything I know that a great leader is. So, all right, we're running close on time, but I want to, like, what? And I want to give you, if there's something I've asked that we haven't talked about and you want to talk about, but I wanted to kind of feel like, you know, what are your biggest challenges like now? Like, what are your biggest challenges? And you can talk personally and professionally, either way.
So, a couple of things. Biggest challenge personally, my wife has been going through a battle with ovarian cancer since 2018. Yeah. And she's been through 4 surgical procedures, 31 chemotherapy treatments, and probably 100 doctor's appointments.
Yeah.
And man, is she tough. Yeah. So what I have learned watching her and adjusting the role I need to play based on how she's doing is probably the biggest, or definitely is the biggest challenge I've ever faced. But she and I are definitely tighter, closer. Marriage is stronger now than it was before this started.
Yeah.
And I had a member actually, you know, one of the great things about this place, when word got out what she was going through, I had guys putting their arm around me. And one member specifically pulled me aside and said, "Hey, I've been where you are. I'll tell you up front, it didn't end well. But while she was going through it, it's the best our marriage ever was." Yeah. And I've gone back to him since then and pulled him aside and said, "You know, I didn't understand what you were talking about at the time. I get it now. And thanks," yeah, "because you're right."
Yeah.
So, you know, that puts everything in perspective.
Yeah.
And then
absolutely
managing our kids through that, who are 23 and 21. Two great kids. One just got out of school from University of North Carolina, a daughter, and she's going to go to law school next fall. And our son's in his third year at the University of Virginia. And they're both, they've got great futures. And we're protecting them from this a little bit. And then we're, they know what's going on, but they don't know what's going on. So that's easily the biggest challenge, personally. Professionally, you know, I got to keep from getting lazy. I've been here 25 years, and I've got a bunch of skins on the wall. And people talk about how great I am. But the member that gets in the club next month, you know, he's happy to know the things I've done before he got here. But that doesn't guarantee that he's going to be happy with the things I'm going to do with him now that he is here. So I can't let up. And the young people that come to work for me that want to become the best version of themselves and they believe I can get them there, I've got to live up to that. I can't just mail it in and say, "Well, talk to these guys. This is how they did it when they were here." I've got to get to know them. I've got to invest in them. I've got to coach them. And I think that's my biggest professional. I just can't let up.
Yeah. And yeah.
The good news for me is that I get the purpose for me is developing people. And it still feels really, really good to help somebody.
Yeah.
So I'm going to keep doing it because the payback I get is getting to watch them succeed and know that I had a part in it.
Yeah.
And know I'm going to have a relationship with that guy and he's going to be 40 years old someday and I'm going to be old and retired and I'm going to go see him, have lunch with him, play golf at his place, listen to what he's going through. And I'm going to enjoy the heck out of that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no better compensation for me. I'm with you at that same point in my life, like watching these young lieutenants out there, some Army golfers, you know, that they're out there in the Iron Dome in Israel. I got two of them that are air defenders that are out there fighting, you know, they're overseas. And like the payback I get from them, there's no dollars. This, you can't put a price on that feeling. I totally agree. And then like, I didn't realize your wife was fighting that. And every day, you know, July 1st of last year, I have lived longer, you know, the days, I know it's over 270 now, but I've lived longer than my dad. He passed away at 53 fighting cancer, same way. And, you know, it's hard to identify the reference point you're mentioning, you know, like to take advantage of each day when you know your time is limited. And we know that even without these, like, these diseases coming into our lives, but to reflect back when it hits you in this adversity, that how valuable each day is and where is that true value that you're making in your life. It does not surprise me at all that you and your wife are closer than ever because I have not met her yet. And I hope I get to meet her soon, that you guys are great teammates for each other. So, and that our teams are the best insurance plan that we can have in our lives. So I love to hear that your members are also falling right in with you. And that is the well of, and the deep well that you have of support, I think, that probably you, both of y'all have, because I'm sure she knows the members very well also. We will keep you guys in our thoughts and prayers to get her through that thing. I'll also mention one thing, because my dad was fighting cancer. It brought our family closer together. And I was 21 whenever he first announced this to us. And we had not been very close. We had like a little break in contact. for about 3 years from my 18th birthday. I got in trouble, and then he towed the line on me and pushed me out there. And then I kind of came back. But I think that experience brought our family so close together. And I know the kids, your kids right now, I don't know that. I'm a Tar Heel graduate, so I appreciate the ACC, UNC, VA, UVA. Yeah, I did my PhD there. But those guys, them two surely are probably showing you the best of what you have raised. And there's nothing more fulfilling than to have your kids there in this kind of adversity. So God bless y'all, man. That is a tough thing to get through. And I was always amazed by the optimism my dad showed. And I never saw him really feeling sorry for himself. And he never went down that pathway of self-pity and just kept us above water the whole time. So anyway, I'm a better man today because of him. And I know you are because of your wife. So
yeah. No question.
Awesome. Awesome, no question. Man. God, no question. I'm definitely going to keep you in our prayers for sure. Well, thanks. We're coming up on the last bit here, and I don't want to hold you up. So I want to give you the last word. And I feel like we could do this every week, and we would learn more about how we could get better now with you. So let me give you the last word, Cameron. This has been a joy for me, man. I don't know how I walked into getting this opportunity, but to meet people like you is a tremendous reward for me. So I'll give you the last word, man. Yeah.
So I feel the same way. Having this conversation. We chatted for a few minutes at the show, but having this interaction and hearing how you've done things and tying things back to your experience in the military, where the stakes are a whole lot higher than they are in the golf business, and nobody's bleeding where we are. So thanks for sharing. I think what I would, my last couple of words would be, we talked a little while about how golf at a competitive level breeds selfishness. And I've been around some Hall of Fame players, Lee Trevino, Lanny Watkins, David Graham, I know very well. And to succeed at the level they did, I can see kind of the selfish thing when they have to turn it on, and I understand it. But the golf business is a team sport, not an individual sport. Mm-hmm. And I believe those of us that have been fortunate enough to have a great life in it, like I have, we owe it to the business and the people that follow us to share what we've learned and spend time with the next generation and help them be better than we were. I'm a big believer in leave it better than you found it. So those that are listening that are my age, if you're not doing that, I ask you to think about doing that. And those that are younger now that are learning from this, remember that there were some older guys that took the time to share what they learned. So when you get to that stage, you do the same thing. And then the last piece, just talk a little bit about motivation. You know, the media talks about leaders and motivators, and they kind of make them sound like they're screamers and yellers. And Nick Saban, when he's in the intensity of a game, and they show him all wound up, and he's yelling at whatever his coordinator's doing, or he's in the face of the player that made the mistake, I feel like that the world thinks that's where leadership is, and it's not. That's the heat of battle, maybe. Yeah. But the bigger piece of leadership is the leader's got to be willing to invest in the people that he or she is responsible for leading and get to know what their life is like and share with them what it's going to take to be successful and lead by example. You said it very well a little while ago. We are definitely always on a stage. Got to be okay with that. And you got to be able to live up to your own standards and show the young people that this is how you do it. And they'll remember that.
Yeah.
They'll remember that.
Yeah, absolutely. I am, of all the ones I've done, I'm sure we're all better now today. So thank you for helping us get there, man. And I would ask all the audience, and I know we will keep you and you and your family in our thoughts and prayers. I know that the quality of the teammates you've created around you just in this short conversation is tremendous, and that you have some real dense and viscous relationships because you are such an inspirational person and you're not hiding anything. I feel like I can see your soul, and it's so pure. So our thoughts and prayers with y'all, man. And thank you so much for joining us today on Getting Better Now.
Thanks, Spencer.
All righty.
Thank you for tuning into the GBN University podcast. Remember, greatness in the golf industry is within reach. Stay inspired, stay informed, and keep striving for excellence. Until next time, this is GBN University signing off. Don't forget to hit subscribe for more invaluable insights.